Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With me today as co-host is Daniel McAdams. Daniel, good to see you.
How are you this morning, Dr. Paul?
Very good. All Daniel, right. We have a good guest today,
yes,
interesting
indeed.
Guest. He's written a book, which I found very fascinating, and we're going to get to interview him. The author's name is Graham Summers, and Graham, I want to welcome you to our program.
It's a pleasure to be here, Dr. Paul.
Very good. Now, I want to show the audience what we're going to be talking about because it's your recent book, and it's available, and it's a title that's very catchy. And here it is, the Everything Bubble. That should catch people's attention. But the subtitle is The End Game for Central Bank Policy. Now, that's interesting as well. But the whole thing is in this book, you do go into a lot of the bubbles and, the tragedy of it all and the seriousness of it. And you've been in the financial business for a long time, as I understand. So you see this both from a financial viewpoint, but your book is more economics. And that's what, fascinated me. And I want to start off, Graham, by asking you, where did you get interested in this type of information? Because you're dealing with monetary policy. There's some people involved in finances, they're really not into it. They're traders, they're in and out, and they mark, and they're pretty smart, and they make a lot of money sometimes. But you knew about the cycles, and that's what you talk about. Where did you find your interest? When did you get started in looking at the economy in that manner?
Well, I was hired right out of college by an investment research house in the Mid-Atlantic, and I worked there about 5 years. And at that time, I was one of the analyst trader types who primarily focused on financial markets. And the big picture was of interest to me, but mainly in terms of trying to decide what was going to move price in the markets. And I left there to start my own company in 2008. And during that time, I realized that there were some holes in my thinking, and I spent a lot of time doing more research on the big picture kind of thing. And that occurred right as the crisis was beginning. I distinctly remember Bear Stearns going bust, and all of these things were happening during the first year of me having my own firm. And so what quickly struck me was I really love to read, I love to analyze, so I was voraciously digesting everything I could, and it was very clear to me that we had a crisis on our hands and that we were going to see some sort of crash or meltdown in that autumn. And I actually went on record in the spring of that year, said we're going to have a full-blown crash, it's going to be the worst we've had in many, many decades. And then since that time, what concerned me was seeing the way that the central banks were responding to that crisis. Now, when you have a crisis, there is an excuse to use extreme policy if you're trying to stop the system from collapsing. I'm not one of those people who thinks just, pull the plug, let everything go bust. But what really began to concern me was that in the aftermath of the crisis, once things had kind of turned around a bit, these policies just became normalized. So what would have been, say, something you'd do in response to a meltdown became just standard policy. Mm-hmm. And as that progressed, I became more and more concerned. And I also sensed that there wasn't really an awareness. Everywhere I went, whether it was the bank or the post office, I'd hear people talking about the crisis. I'd hear people talking about the Fed. But it was very clear that this information is really just not out there in an accessible way. So I decided I was going to write a book, and the goal of the book was to make finance and economics and the business cycle as simple to understand as possible. And so I spent quite a lot of time writing and rewriting and rewriting, and the goal was, to educate the general populace about how did the financial system get set up, why is it set up the way it is, why are we having crises almost every 10 years now, why is it we seem to go from just one asset bubble to a crash to the next asset bubble. And then the second half of the book is what's going to be happening in the coming turn when the cycle changes. Yeah.
Right. I want to go over the title a little bit more because it might not mean the same thing to everybody, because I think everything is a bubble. But I include in that, all the debt. Everybody has the debt. I look at the malinvestment, which not too many people look at, mistakes made, and then I go back to the real culprit, which is the Federal Reserve rigging the price of money, and that is the interest rates, and that everything gets distorted. Is that about where you are on the definition, or would you describe it a little bit differently, what everything means?
Sure. No, that's absolutely right. So what happened, what you should think about is this. In the early 70s, when the U.S. completely disconnected the dollar from the gold standard, what that allowed was exponential debt creation. And we, of course, had started that process in the 30s, but it was really in 1971 with former President Richard Nixon that gold was completely broken from the dollar. So what that means is from that point forward, the United States would be paying all of its debts exclusively in dollars, but these were dollars that the Federal Reserve can print at whim. So what happens, and there's a chart in the book where basically you see kind of the GDP growth going like this, but you see debt growth going exponentially sharper, higher. And what happened was by the time you get to the mid-90s, there's just so much debt in the system that the Federal Reserve chose to intentionally create asset bubbles in order to stop the system from deflating enough that the debt markets imploded.
Right.
And so in the late 90s, we had the tech bubble. That was a bubble in technology stocks. That bubble burst. Alan Greenspan, who at that time was the head of the Fed, cut interest rates well below economic activity. Now, when you do that, what you're basically doing is making money free, because if it costs less to borrow than the economy is growing, you can basically borrow that money and pile it into any asset class and you'll do okay.
Mm-hmm.
So Greenspan did that. That's what allowed the housing bubble to be created. Now, it wouldn't necessarily have been a housing bubble if the government hadn't passed certain legislation, but that's perhaps a discussion for another time.
Mm-hmm.
So then that bubble burst. And what the Fed did this time was really quite, if you think about it, really quite arrogant. They decided they're going to try and corner the bond market, which brings me back to the 70s. When the U.S. broke away from the gold standard, the issue was what's going to be the ultimate backstop for the financial system, because it's no longer gold, and you can't really claim it's the dollar either, because the dollar is going to be losing purchase power really rapidly because it's being printed so aggressively. So what became the backstop was U.S. sovereign debt, which is called treasuries. And this became what's known as the risk-free rate of return. So the interest rates that that debt pays is considered the risk-free rate of return. And every other asset class, stocks, bonds, real estate, all of those are priced based on their riskiness relative to that rate. So when 2008 happened, the Fed tried to corner bonds, and it cut interest rates to abnormal lows. And in so doing, it was cornering the risk-free rate of return, which consequentially meant that every asset class began to adjust to a phony risk profile.
Right.
And now if they'd done that for, say, a year or two, it wouldn't have been as big of a deal. But they kept it like that for 7 years.
Yeah.
And what happened was eventually every asset class, whether you're talking corporate bonds, you're talking stocks, you're talking real estate, all of them began to adjust to this ridiculously false risk profile. And so the way I put it is, if you create a bubble in U.S. sovereign bonds, you're going to ultimately create a bubble in everything. And that's how we got the title of the book, The Everything Bubble.
Right. Daniel, I think he has a question.
Of course.
Well, Graham, I think I'm your targeted reader because I'm not an expert in these issues by any stretch of the imagination. And I actually really enjoyed and found refreshing how easy it was to understand some of the basic definitions that you give. And Dr. Paul and I both were talking about your chapter on the war on cash, which was really really interesting, but you make a very good point that I think a lot of people that aren't as expert as you two are might not fully understand, which is that the government hates cash. The Fed hates cash. They view cash as the enemy. Maybe if you could explain that to some of the people who are less expert, it might make some sense.
Sure. So the way I would think about it is this, is when you talk about money, money today in the financial system is predominantly just digital electrons that's being transferred between different bank servers. And that's not some kind of weird conspiracy theory. The Fed actually tracks this information. So if you look at the amount of currency in circulation, and we're talking just currency, it's not actually a house or stocks, it's about $11 trillion. And of that, maybe 1.3 is actual physical cash, meaning dollars and coins. And then on top of that, you stack all the various paper asset classes, such as stocks, real estate, bonds, et cetera. But again, very rarely are you actually owning anything. I mean, unless it's a hard asset like a house, you're talking about you're betting on a paper product that's essentially trading hands and being valued by the markets. So in this sort of scenario, the kind of dirty secret is that almost all of this wealth is electronic. And one of the few ways that you can actually get money out of the system is physical cash. And the way this was something that was kind of known on the outskirts of things, but it only became very explicit during the crisis in Europe that they had back in 2011, 2012. Because what happened was in 2014, the European Central Bank cut interest rates to negative. So when they did that, what they were doing was that would mean that the money I keep at the bank would start being charged rather than them paying me interest on those deposits. And what happened was people, being sensible, said, well, why am I going to leave my money in the bank if I'm going to be charged, you know, 0.4%? I can just take it out in the form of cash and put it in a safe. And one of the sort of secondary effects of that was that we had a lot of safe sellers making just absolute bank during those years. But what this quickly revealed to those who may not have been paying as much attention is that cash is actually one of the few kind of loopholes in our current system. And so as a result of that, the Federal Reserve and other central banks, they really just like cash, because what that means is it offers one of the means through which you can get your money away from the interest rate that they use to control the price of money, which subsequently controls the price of various other asset classes. So the war on cash, as far as I can see, is something that's been floating around in kind of high-level insider circles for years. In fact, the paper that I reference in the book was written back in 2001 by a guy who's gone on to be a consultant at three separate central banks. But now you've got guys like Larry Summers, who's no relation of mine, and other people saying, let's get rid of these dollar bills. You know, we need to do this to get rid of it's money laundering, or wait, no, it's drug dealing. Well, no, it's none of those things. It's actually they want to create a system through which every financial transaction is easily checked and tracked via electronic records. Cash is one of the few means that you can't do that, so they'd like to get rid of it.
You know, there's a seductiveness for our society and the whole system with accumulating debt. Because people now will go into debt just about for anything. Look at look at the student debt and car debt and housing debt. That hasn't always been that way. I remember my parents saving enough money to go buy a house, or they wouldn't think about these this borrowing. And now people don't have enough equity in their car, and they just add it on and go to get a new car, and they still get it. But it isn't like all of a sudden the people got selfish in the sense, well, immediate gratification. But it also fits into a whole philosophy that so many of us have been taught in school, that we worry too much about debt. Debt isn't good. Debt isn't bad. Debt is good. And the liberal says that. They encourage that. They think it's the worst thing in the world is not to go in debt. So that is, to me, one of the things that I deal with in the work that I do, is trying to get people to understand the basics of why people are willing to go and do these things, because it really doesn't make any sense. You know, when you think about it, and then when you see the bubbles that you've been writing about and witnessing, all of a sudden people say, yeah, it really doesn't make any sense. So it to me looks like we need an awakening, not the type where you have the NASDAQ bubble crash and then they get bailed out. But I think there's a time coming where there's going to be a real need for a real awakening, and we're going to have to deal this with a significant monetary reform and maybe a change in philosophy on government as well.
Agreed. So the real issue that you're bringing up is that most of these things we're experiencing, you could kind of think of this as the greatest financial experiment in history, and that would be the period from the late 60s, the early 70s onward, because it was around that time that every nation just completely disconnected their currency from gold. And it's not that I'm necessarily a gold bug, but it's just that the idea, it's very basic common sense. If there's nothing backing your currency, then there's really no reason why you can't print as much as you want. Now, the Keynesians, which is a school of economics, have this view that that's not really a problem, because the argument is, well, if I'm going to pay my debt with my currency, and my central bank can print that currency at any time, I'll never be able to go broke. But of course, that's not true, because countries go broke all the time. We've seen this with Venezuela recently. We see it with Argentina every 10 years or so. Greece went broke a few years ago. And so really the situation is, as you raised that point, this is not a normal era. And it's funny you should mention it, but a good friend of mine read the book, and he actually brought up that when his grandparents passed, he was given access to their estate. He was in charge of managing it. And he went into their safe deposit box in the bank, and they just had cash stacked up in the box. And it was because they'd experienced the Great Depression, and they didn't trust actual banks, and they had never really outgrown that view. And they decided, well, they wanted to keep their money in currency. But that at that time, gold was still connected currency, so it wasn't losing as much purchasing power as rapidly as it is now. And so to him, it was this cultural shock. Wow, you know, 50 years ago, 60, 70 years ago, cash was something everyone wanted to sit on and own, because they actually didn't trust other things.
So, Daniel?
You know, Graham, we deal a lot with the implications of some of these theories that you talk about. We deal a lot with dollar hegemony, with the dollar as the reserve currency of the world, and all of the distortions. Maybe even that's a big bubble, too. But I wanted to throw something out at you to see what you thought about it. We've heard a little bit of the rumblings, China and Russia wanting to trade in shared currencies, in oil, the issue with Iran, how's it going to sell oil if the dollar is the currency? Well, here's actually a close NATO ally of ours. This is Erdogan, the president of Turkey, a close ally of the U.S. Here's what he said yesterday, and I want to get your reaction and see if you think this might be more than just a little bit of rumblings around the edges. He said, quote, "We need to gradually end the monopoly of the dollar once and for all by using local and national currency among us." That sounds a little more significant than just these minor things. Is this maybe the seeds of a future big crash?
You know, that's a really tough one because Turkey is such a small economy and their monetary system is so minor. It's very tempting to see things like that and think those terms. One thing I always try to keep in the back of my head, especially when I start getting very pessimistic about everything, is that the U.S. dollar comprises 86% of all global currency trades. So if I'm in Japan and I want to trade over into euros, I don't go from yen to euros. I go yen to dollars, then to euros. And the dollar's involved in 86% of that. The dollar comprises over 70% of global foreign reserves. The dollar comprises a massive amount of debt issuance as well, even in countries that don't necessarily use the dollar for their economy. So I try to remember that because when we talk about the dollar being abandoned, you're really talking about a systemic change. You're talking about something that was similar to like the nothing any of us have seen in the last 100 years. So actually experiencing that and what that's going to be like is very hard to predict. I do think you raised some very good points that you're starting to see China and Russia try to challenge the United States in terms of currency dominance. Now, if you combine their two economies, it's still smaller than the U.S. economy. We're still the biggest one. But you're right. What we basically have is certain powers starting to want to challenge that. Now, whether they'll be successful or not is very difficult to say, and it's something that you'd have to keep your eye on. Me personally, I'm not concerned about Turkey. If Turkey was then joined by, say, Germany and some other countries and started piling on, then it would be cause for concern. But really what you're talking about is what is the big crisis, you know, the one we've all been talking about since the 70s. And it's very hard to tell when that's going to start. You'd have to sort of take note of some of these things and see it progress. But if Turkey was the beginning of something, we're very early on. We're definitely very early on.
Graham, we all need to finish up. I do want to get you to make a comment about the student debt bubble, because it's around there and it's big. And there was a statistic just out. It said 1 million defaults per year in the student zone. And what is it, $1.3 trillion or so?
Yes, and it's the size of a country, yeah.
The dilemma is going to be, and it's already started, that they won't. Once it gets that big, there will be defaults. They're in the middle. It's going to cause a lot of antagonism. So some people paid it off and they took it seriously. They paid it off. But eventually, you know, this will be defaulted on. And it's going to cause a lot of problems. And do you predict that how will that come about? Will it just be steady, like, you know, a million a year until it's all over? Or how do you think this is going to be resolved?
That's a really multifaceted problem because you're talking about universities, which are one of the few items in the economy where the price just keeps going up no matter what. You're also talking about funny money, the price of things going to ways in which you have to take on debt to afford these things. You're also talking about, I mean, one of the key issues with debt, and something we forget, is debt's not always a four-letter word in the sense that it's not always a bad thing. You know, if I take on debt for my business or I take on debt for a student loan, but then I leave school and I get a really good job, then that debt was well used and I service the loan and I pay it off and I'm fine. What's problematic is that a lot of people are getting taken on debt to get degrees that don't actually manifest into jobs. And so then the debt becomes sort of a shackle on their livelihood. And that's really the tipping point if you want to approach debt as a standalone subject. Yeah. Is whenever debt becomes unserviceable because you're not actually able to put it to good use, it becomes a problem. Now, in terms of the student debt problem, you're going to have a couple things happen. You're going to have the financial firms or the schools that are closely related to lots of student loans. Once the defaults start spiking, those companies will get into trouble. The more interesting component is going to be the social one, which is what do you do when you have all these young people who are just pissed off, massively in debt, they can't get good jobs. cost to service the debt, and so they're frustrated. Well, we're starting to see this beginning of that with Bernie Sanders and some of the socialists, because basically they're just saying, well, let's make all this stuff free. You won't have the debt anymore. But that's kind of a social construct that's starting to manifest. For certain, it could be the beginning of a mini crisis. What would be a bigger concern for me would be, does the student loan bubble start to spread to other bubbles? Do you start to see, say, subprime auto loans blowing up? Do you see even real estate blowing up? Because for you to get a really significant crisis, you need to see an asset class that's dominant, like housing or stocks, start to melt down, and then you're going to see a systemic issue arise. Whether or not student debt is large enough and whether or not enough's going to default is very difficult to say, but this is an issue that I think from a liberty perspective, it really is making a lot of people aware, hey, wait, why is this happening? You know, why is the system this way? Why am I so in debt? I can't get a job that I can pay it off with, you know, those sorts of things. So hopefully that'll be some of that wake-up call you were discussing earlier.
Great. And we're about to close, but I want to put your book up one more time for the audience to see. The Everything Bubble, Graham Summers. Graham, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Dr. Paul. Thank you.
All right. And I want to thank the viewers today for tuning in. Please tune in to Liberty Report soon.